There is a certain amount of noise you just get used to if you live in a city or a suburb. The sounds of the traffic, a car stereo, a loud conversation, and the noise can be visual, too. An unkempt yard, litter on the ground, or some badly drawn graffiti. If you're lucky, you can just slap on a pair of headphones and sink your face into a smartphone app and drown out all that horrible noise. But that noise continues in the virtual world. It's just harder to notice. The sense of control we think we have with the adoption of smartphones and digital technology is quickly followed by a kind of drowning sensation, a feeling of floundering in a sea of information, spam, email lists, social network streams, text messages from friends, and an increasing number of flashy websites and apps, all engineered to steal our attention. Before the digital revolution, the biggest problem we might have had to cope with was too much noise and not enough substance. But by camouflaging themselves as useful signals, digital interruptions are introducing more and more noise insidiously into our lives. And discerning what is signal and what is noise is an imperfect activity at best, and self-destructive at worst. Kate Crawford is an associate professor in media research at the University of New South Wales. She has spent some time researching how noise inserts itself into our lives. She spoke with David Weinberger about the history of noise and how noise lives on in the digital world.
Well, noise has become part of this sort of broader rubric around how we engage with digital information, and particularly we see it as being evidenced around the idea of information overload, that by using things like mobile phones, text messages, and also email, social media messages, all of these forms of data coming at us all the time, that it's constituting a kind of digital noise that we have to navigate on a kind of a daily basis.
And in this case, the noise is communications from other people about whatever it is you're not interested in. It might be Twitter or
Absolutely.
Facebook.
Absolutely. And maybe it's interesting and maybe it's not. But the point is you have to wade through enormous amounts of it in order to find out. So in terms of the information overload debate, I think the term noise is actually used in quite a lazy way, that it's just referred to all of this information that is around us all the time. But in actual fact, when we see in the sorts of studies that we've been doing in Australia, that people are very good at actually detecting what kinds of signals are going to be useful to them and what things they're going to discard. But certainly what we are seeing is a sort of an increase in signals, and therefore the argument goes also an increase in the proportion of noise. And sometimes these are directed messages. It's an email directly to you, or it's coming from Twitter, or it's coming from Facebook. And sometimes it's just news updates and other forms of kind of pressures on human attention that are sort of falling under this term of noise.
And this is a change in our idea of noise from a pre-information society view of it?
Well, actually, in my work, I think it's really important to look at the history of how we thought about noise. I think there are a lot of similarities. When we go back to, say, debates in the 17th century about the growing industrialization of cities, that noise was the term that people were particularly interested in. It's like the noise is unbearable. There's too many people all in one place. And the history of city design has seen that actually, over time, people found that noise to be really inspiring and exciting, and that cities were these vibrant and interesting places to be. Rather than being a source of constant complaint, it became part of what was expected as being the space of the city. And I think we can see a parallel in terms of how people are engaging with networked and social environments, that in fact, the high level of information, some of which is relevant, some of which is not, is actually a process of adaptation and growth, very similar to the way that we think about the history of the city.
And yet there is a history of urban noise being extremely aggravating to people, especially when it comes from parts of the culture that the person does not share in. Street noise, street music. There's certainly a 19th century history of street music just driving people nuts, not appropriating it, but actually driving divisions in the city.
That's right. And this is how we can think about the borders, about how we share sound spaces in cities. And it's a really complex negotiation, and it goes on over time. So again, these are not easily resolvable questions. And I think the idea of what is noise to one person is highly subjective. But it's interesting because once we start deploying that term in information environments, we start to think about, okay, so what constitutes noise to you? How do you actually engage with that noise? So that's the sort of the first sort of individual question about how we manage these kinds of information questions. But the second one, I think, is how do we deal with this collectively? So that's to relate to your question about street music, this is a collective issue. We have communities dealing with the fact that, okay, this is a corner where we have buskers, or this is a corner where, you know, guys with boomboxes are gathering. How do we navigate that issue? It's navigated collectively as a community. So part of what I'm really interested in my work at the moment is thinking about the kinds of collective questions and collective approaches to management of digital signal and noise that we can actually engage in over the next 10 years.
So one of your points is, as I understand it, is that we are currently engaged in complex social negotiations over what noise is permitted where, what signal is permitted where, because it turns into a noise in some environments. But that over time we will develop norms, because that's what we always do. Maybe that won't happen on the internet. It happens in the real-world urban environment because you can physically separate groups. You can say, this corner, no busking, or no busking from, you know, after 11 or whatever, and you can get the cops out and all the rest of it. And the norms can be shared because there's a physical space that can be negotiated. Mm. On the net, first of all, there are multiple cultures that are contending for a space, and there isn't the authority. There isn't the landscape that permits that type of authority, and there isn't the authority to enforce the norms. So are you confident that we are, in fact, going to resolve sort of the old noise question in the new environment?
I think it's already happening, to be really honest with you. I think what we're seeing is already a kind of selection of spaces that people are engaged with every day, where people say, I'm looking at Twitter, people are talking about what they're having for lunch, I can't have this much information in my working life, I'm not going to join that space. Or we see, again, people leaving Facebook because they have concerns about the way that information is not only being sent to them, but also what's happening to their information, so privacy questions. These all get down to choosing your communities and choosing your space, which again maps, I think, very beautifully to your example about cities and street sound, is that people will move into communities where they say, well, this is the kind of level of noise that I can deal with. This is a suburb where I feel at home, or I really want to live in the absolute heart of the city where it's noisy all the time and it's creatively inspiring. So it's an analogy where I think it's basically about community choice, about the kinds of spaces that you want to live in and inhabit, and how you then make those negotiations. And to give a bit of context on this, the way that I got to really thinking about noise was primarily through the concept of listening, because I think listening is a term that tends to be underused, certainly in my area, which is in media and communication studies. It's been really focused on voice. So when we think about the internet, it's about, you know, having a voice in a space, contributing your voice, you know, via your blog, and this democratic participatory process, which relates to a very kind of libertarian model of what the internet is doing. But what's really lacked in that analysis is any concept of listening, of who's listening, of the importance of having people around in these network spaces, on blogs, in social media space, who are just listening. They aren't necessarily leaving comments or contributing. They're making part of this process of how they engage with your forms of speech. So by focusing on listening is how I actually got to these ideas around noise. It's that once you're actually involved in listening environments, so that environment might be Twitter or Facebook, you're used to checking it 20 or 30 times, where is the limit to that listening? Where do we say, this is too much for me? Because I think that's really the root of the information overload debates, where people are saying, okay, I'm suddenly, in the last 6 years, I've been exposed to brand new environments, Facebook, Twitter, MySpace, they simply didn't exist a decade ago. How am I going to navigate these listening in these particular environments? At what point is that listening really productive and conducive to me and useful to me? And at what point is it actually overwhelming and distressing and noise-like?
Does this, I'm going to put this in the most negative way possible. Okay?
Oh, please.
If the analogy is sort of getting inverted in that, rather than declaring a corner to be a quiet zone from 8 till 12 or whatever, the fluidity of the net, which lacks that sort of set geography, instead allows us to cluster to move to places that are quiet. We don't want to be over in this forum because it's too noisy, but this one's nice and quiet, whatever that means for us, where we can listen. You're going to cluster with people who are not talking noisily, which means people who are like you. Does an emphasis on listening reinforce what seems to be a natural tendency for us to cluster with in nice safe zones where there are people who are like us and we never have to listen to anything that might be noisy to us?
Well, let me first say that I'm really reluctant to divide people into speakers and listeners, because I think what we all do, in particularly in online environments, is we move between these modes all the time. We move between making contributions, giving comments, through to listening to what other people are saying and what they're doing. So first of all, I think we see this as a dynamic. It's a dynamic between speaking and listening in online environments. And it's actually really useful for me. I'm not trying to say that listening is more important, but that we do need to pay more attention as researchers to these kinds of functions that are clearly a really big part of our day. So to the second part of your question, that, you know, would people sort of cluster with like minds? I think that's already happening. I think that's true. I don't think we're seeing the creation of silent spaces on the internet where people who are all, you know, relatively don't have much to say are hanging out together. But what I do think we're seeing is that people are naturally gravitating towards spaces that have a level of signal that they can cope with. So in high information industries, we see a real reliance on tools like Twitter and Facebook to try and get, you know, up to the minute detail and information about what's going on in their field. But if you look to other genres, particularly sort of blue-collar work, where it's seen less as being an important part of what it is to be productive, then different kinds of spaces are used, and often outside of the workplace. So even on the sort of the day-to-day modalities of what you're doing in your time, people choose their communities for the kinds of signal and noise that they can actually work with productively. Certainly the people who have written about the internet as a place of speech and creativity are also very good listeners. It's just that that has not been the focus of research, that process of what it is to be an audience in these spaces, of actually be witnessing, to be present, to contribute to those communities, not by adding in, you know, necessarily your 2 cents all the time. You're not a high volume addition. You're not posting a million Facebook updates or tweets, but that this is actually an important part of what constitutes their communities. That's actually an important part of why people go there, because they have people who are listening to them.
So why has that been so widely missed? Is it a problem with our notion of community that we have, we've defined it or understood communities in terms of the active and loudest participation?
I think it is a problem. I think it has actually been a fairly problematic omission in terms of the research. But I do understand it, and I think there are some very good reasons why we've got to this point. Partly because it's really hard to study listening. It's very easy to study objects in internet space where people are making things or they're having debates and they're having contributions. I mean, this is something that we can look to, we can analyze it, we can quantify it, and we can talk about it. We can say this is what happens on the internet. But actually, it's a very small percentage of the time that is spent in online environments. So how do we account for that kind of time? How do we look at these things that have previously been called lurking, but actually we now see is, you know, what we do all the time, or certainly 90% of our time? That is, to me, a big and fascinating research question.
Kate Crawford is an associate professor in media research at the University of New South Wales. She's been studying modes of participation on the net and the forces that allow us to engage online. David Weinberger asked Kate if the social net can really be divided into talkers and listeners.
How confident are you that dividing involvement on the net into, talking and listening, or dividing information into signal or noise, how confident are you that those are useful and usefully distinct categories?
Well, I find them fascinating, and they've certainly opened up new spaces of theoretical possibility in my research, and I think they're useful for media studies. I'm not claiming that these are the be-all and end-all terms, but I think what they give us is a really nice way of looking at the areas which have been under-researched. So that as soon as we start talking about speaking and listening rather than just having a voice on the internet, we've opened up a whole new different way of thinking about participation. So this is also something that I've been working on with Nancy Baim. We're trying to analyse modes of participation that also include these kinds of listening modes, these receptive modes, because they often are just not even seen as being participation in a space at all. Let me give you an example. Forrester used this thing called the ladder of participation,
which is the Forrester research group.
Absolutely right, the Forrester research group. And what they like to do is they classify in a hierarchy from the bottom to the top models of participation. And at the bottom we have inactives, and then we move up to people who are, you know, observing, through to critics, and they've just included the category of conversationalists, and at the top we have creators. And this is a very clear pyramid about, we know who's on the bottom, we know who's on the top, and in Forrester's language, it's about encouraging your user base to move up the pyramid, to become more like creators who are actually, you know, creating things and sharing them on the internet. I think this is a little problematic, and I think it's a little problematic because, first of all, it really places the greatest value on the people who are doing the speaking, that that's actually where all of the important participation is occurring. And I would really disagree with that. And certainly, you know, there's some really strong evidence from my studies and from others that, in fact, listeners are just as important in these environments as speakers. So the hierarchy is a problem. But the other problem, I think, is that it's trying to suggest that people are fixed in one state or the other. You know, you've worked your way up to the top of the pyramid and now you're a creator. And if you're down the bottom, then this is a problem. You need to, you know, you need to work harder.
We almost always read pyramids as not just narrowing at the top, but the value moving up.
That's right. That's correct. And not only that, I mean, Forrester have been explicit about that, that actually it is about trying to encourage audiences to move up. In actual fact, these are modalities. We're moving through them all the time. You're not fixed as being one or the other. The people are actually moving between these, often dozens of times in the course of a day, where you might comment on this and then you're just going to go and have a listen to see what's happening in Facebook, and maybe then you're going to write an email. But these kinds of literacies that we have about moving between spaces where we're contributing and then listening, it's happening all the time, but we just haven't been studying it. And I think, for me, what I find really fascinating about the terms of, you know, listening and noise, is that we can open up those spaces for research. So I'm not suggesting that they're, you know, the talismans that will help us completely understand the internet. But what I am suggesting is that herein lies a new kind of research, a new pathway to be thinking about what it is to participate in online environments.
So if this is a new area of research, or one that's been underappreciated, namely the internet as an internet of listeners, which is, as has to be, as you say, sort of hope that there are way more listening than talking in the course of a day. Are there gender and class issues that might help explain why we've got the pyramid in a pyramid? That way instead of pointy the other way?
Absolutely. And this is where I think the really interesting research, you know, remains to be done, and something that I'm particularly interested in my current work, is that actually these ideas around listening and noise are very much based around ideas of class. And we can see this, I'm particularly interested in reading this through different kinds of workplaces, so looking at white-collar and no-collar workplaces versus blue-collar workplaces. But you can also think about it in terms of gender in really productive ways. And again, the idea that, you know, that women are somehow, you know, constantly chattering on the internet, and that the spaces where they're doing this are somehow not important, this isn't, you know, real information and it's actually just noise, is a really common discourse that we see emerging in these spaces. So again, these issues, I think, are the ones that haven't been looked at, and particularly around the class politics of noise. If we look at the sorts of groups that are most concerned about noise and information noise, particularly information overload, we're looking at information elites. These are people who are often very educated, middle class, working in white-collar environments, who already have very high literacies in navigating these kinds of information spaces. But the difficulty they find is that there are so many new sources of information that for them to remain competitive, to be excellent in their field, they suddenly have to engage with all of these different spaces and different kinds of communicative styles, and this is becoming a noise problem. Whereas in actual fact, it's a very clear kind of pressure in particular sorts of spaces, and I'd say these are very classed spaces, around the power of information and how we engage with it. So I think that's a really important research question.
History is written by the writers.
That's right, but it's consumed by the readers.
Kate Crawford is an associate professor in media research at the University of New South Wales, and has been studying the proliferation of mobile technology. How are people dealing with constant connectivity? Having a smartphone around might be great in case of an emergency, but has it destroyed the concepts of downtime and personal space? David asked her about her research.
So how is this manifesting itself in the research that you're doing?
Well, I've just done 2 years of a three-year study, which is called the Young Mobile Networks Project. And I'm doing this with a colleague called Jared Goggin at the University of New South Wales. And what we've been doing is a very large study. In fact, it's the largest study of mobile and social media use by 18 to 30-year-olds. So we've been travelling the country. We've been gathering interviews, now almost 340 people.
And the country in this case is Australia.
Indeed. You can probably tell from my accent, but yes, indeed, it is coming from Australia. it's also a very important time, I think, for Australia. We've hit the point now where there are more mobiles than people. We've got 110, almost 115% mobile subscription rates in Australia. So it's very much a technology that people are using every day. In terms of noise, one of the themes that kept emerging is just how much people are attached to their mobiles, that they're tuning in all the time over the course of the day. If you have a moment of downtime, you're checking Twitter, you're checking Facebook, you're sending text messages. That this kind of mobile as a listening portal was actually really consistent. So we talked to people about how they were managing all of that information. And this is where I think I was really heartened to see that there is this rapid evolution of norms around how you manage these kinds of data spaces. And rather than being overwhelmed, a lot of the people that we spoke to were seeing it as a problem, were seeing it as an issue in their lives, but they were finding ways to navigate what was noise to them and what was signal to them. And really this is being done through friendship groups, that's where these sorts of normative constructions could be most powerfully located.
Well, can you give us something of a peek about, for example, the difference between urban and rural, since we've been talking about noise in cities? I'm just a little curious about whether that maps at all to mobile noise for
absolutely
cities and rural areas.
It really does. And this was a very interesting finding, given that there's quite a present discourse in mobiles research about a kind of homogenizing factor, that in fact once people are using mobiles, they're actually falling into really similar use patterns. We found something quite different, which was that between our urban and our rural participants, some real variations in terms of how they deal with connection. I should say, because it's important context, that you know, for Australians living in regional and rural areas, reception is not very good, and this is a pressing problem for Australia.
Reception in America everywhere is fantastic.
Yeah, I think
so
we have.
We'll lend you some of our technology. We'll ship it over as soon as we can.
Well, yes, I think there's a shared problem. But certainly in Australia's history, we've seen a real emphasis on urban connectivity, and the regional areas have really sort of lost out in this particular battle. So what we've seen is a very different kind of culture emerge around how you deal with the feeling of constant overconnection. That sense of information overload was very much located in the urban populations, whereas in the rural populations, people had very different perspectives. They were making do with the fact that there was going to be lots of downtime in a network. They would be doing sorts of burst activities, and the periods where networks were up, they would be using this to sort of get all of their various information tasks done, and then they would have periods where they were completely off network. So it was a very kind of, I think, a very common sense approach to how you deal with sort of on-off data environments. But also what I found to be quite interesting were the kinds of techniques that people were using to allow themselves to be off network, to find so-called zones of refusal, to use a term that Genevieve Bell at Intel likes to use. Once you're in a space where connectivity isn't so great, you can use that as a reason to say, well, I'm not going to respond to emails really quickly. I'm not always going to take your call when you ring me. So this idea of actually playing with that downtime as being a useful way to create space, to create quiet zones, was again something that we found really strongly in that
data. It would
be
very interesting to see if there are analogous pretexts that get developed in urban spaces so you don't have to answer your phone. There is the joking common thing in the U.S. of making staticky noises and saying, oh, I'm heading into a tunnel as you're talking.
But this is interesting because I think these are emerging practices, right? These are hacks of how we actually deal with constant connectivity. And they're really important. And another hack that people use is lying. They will simply lie when they're, talking to, their partner, saying, I'm not really in the office. No, I really am in my way home. I'll be there shortly. Or using Twitter to sort of create an impression of, oh, I'm sick. I can't possibly go into work today. Oh, poor me. I'm in bed and I'm watching television, when maybe they're out at the beach. These are the kinds of techniques that are left when so much of our lives are trackable and accountable and you are connected for so much of the time. These are the kinds of little ways that we create space, that we allow ourselves to have off network time and to have unaccountable time. And this, I think, is a really interesting debate, and one that I think comes up very much for me in my work on noise, is thinking about where are the escapes from noise. If noise is the limit of listening, what can we do to actually escape that process?
So you have here what is, in effect, a testable hypothesis, which is to see if over some period of time norms develop. Mm-hmm. Norms.
Absolutely.
So you're not lying.
Indeed.
Right. Lying about not being at the beach is mm-hmm. not exactly a norm. It's a lie. It's
indeed.
Permissible.
Right? Yeah.
Whether norms will develop that make it permissible for us to remain in silence.
That's right. This is something that I think I will be tracking to see if indeed it's true. I think it's going to take some time, though. And let's be clear, this is not a hypothesis that I think we can test in the next couple of years. I think it's going to take longer. But already people even today at Berkman were coming up and telling me about their network holidays, where they would go to places where there's no network coverage and they would take time off network because it was a way of actually, you know, really escaping and taking downtime. This is precisely the emergence of a practice of finding a quiet zone, of finding a time off network, of modulating between noisy environments and quiet or even silent environments. So already I think we can point to a few practices, but we've got a long way to go. And how this much bigger issue of how we deal with spaces like Facebook and Twitter and news and mobiles and texts all being a part of our lives all the time, I think is a shared question. And that's where, again, we can look to norm development, because that's how we see people in societies working out issues together. But I don't think that I have much sympathy with the view that says it's purely an individualistic concern, that if you're finding this environment to be too noisy, you have to change your lifestyle, you have to moderate your use. Because this is a shared problem. A lot of people, certainly around Australia and I think also in the US, are facing this issue at once. And it's something that we're actually having to negotiate. And I think it will take some time, but I'd like to see that hypothesis play out. I think we will see that, you know, people are finding ways to take quiet time off the network.
Thank you so much, Kate.
It was a pleasure. It was lovely to be here. Thank you.
Kate Crawford is an associate professor of media research at the University of New South Wales. She's currently wrapping up some great research on mobile technologies. You can find links to more of her work, including a talk Kate recently gave on her research into mobile environments, on our blog at blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. Do you think that the norms of behavior will evolve on the net? Or are social spaces changing so fast that we'll never really catch up? You can contribute to either the signal or the noise on our blog in the comments section. I should note that the music you heard on today's episode comes courtesy of Kate's band, Clone. The track's called Private Reserve, and you can find out more about Kate's audio work on our website, katecrawford.net. And we'll throw a link up on the blog for that, too. This episode of Radio Berkman was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, with David Weinberger from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts.